Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Martin Gouldstone, Chief Business Officer of Life Sciences, Sensine Health. Sensine Health is based in the UK and calls itself an ethical AI company.
So Martin has been with Sensine since March of last year, and prior to that, he was also CBO for Benevolent AI, among other business growth roles in life sciences with Quintiles, BDO, and Syneos Health. So we wanted to have Martin join us today to update us on the status of AI and data used for clinical research. What exactly is the difference or the story with ethical AI versus other AI, and what Sensine is trying to achieve in this space? So thank you for joining us today, Martin.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Yes, thank you, Martin. So first question to dive into here is, can you explain what ethical AI and ethical data means?
Ethical AI and ethical data sharing is basically essentially in our hands, in our world, a trust model for patient data. So organizations such as Sensine Health generate high value findings from the analysis of patient data. In particular, the deep, rich longitudinal data sets that we have access to through electronic health records. But this information needs to be de-identified and anonymized such that the patient's data and the patient themselves are not identifiable at the individual level. And really, the protections of that and the way that the technology works to both protect the identity of the patient, but still generate incredibly valuable analyses and insights from the patient data sets that can be used to drive the successful prosecution of new drug development, find new treatments, new disease areas, new disease targets is kind of the essential. So having mechanisms in place to ensure that the patient identity is secure and privacy is secure, while still being able to generate useful insights from the data set, is crucial. And our approach is very much on that basis. I think the other way that ethical AI can be implied is also how you partner with those institutions that are supplying you with data. So obviously, our data comes from electronic health records held by NHS trusts, US healthcare systems. And whilst that data is incredibly valuable, it's incredibly important that both the patients and the institutions themselves benefit from sharing that data. So our model is actually almost unique, as far as I know, in our industry, in the way that we partner with those institutions. So when we partner with an NHS trust, for instance, on their data, we have certain things that we do with them. So they become a shareholder in Sensine Health. So Sensine Health is a publicly listed company on AIM, and some 16% of our shareholding, our equity, is actually held by the NHS, by these trusts who get given that equity as a part of our data access agreements with them. We also invest directly into their IT infrastructure to enable them to more usefully and helpfully share their data with us in a format that is both protective of the patient's privacy, but also enables us to maximize the insights we generate from it. And then finally, because obviously we're in a commercial business and we are partnering with large pharma companies to share and develop those insights to develop new drugs, the NHS trusts concerned also get a royalty or a payment off the back of and a proportion of the revenues we generate from our pharma customers. And that money goes straight into improving patient care through those trust organizations. So we feel that not only are we being ethical in terms of data curation, managing the privacy of the patient, but I feel that we're being ethical in that we're giving back to the healthcare systems directly who are responsible for caring for those patients.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard of that kind of model before.
I think it's unique in the sector. I'm aware of the usual sort of model is a sort of pro bono sharing the data back with the healthcare provider of the data. But we are, as far as I know, the only organization that has this kind of double bottom line model, if you will.
So specifically, who's using it right now? Does the NHS use the data that you curate because it's already their records, or you're sending that data back out for pharma to use for clinical trials, recruitment and research, or what exactly are you doing in that area?
Yeah, so I think it's very important here to say that no NHS data or US healthcare system data leaves our company. So what we do is that we partner with pharma companies to generate insights from the data that we hold in order to address problems and exam questions they have. And the sorts of areas that we get involved with pharma companies are comparative real-world data and real-world evidence analysis. So looking at how their drugs perform in real life in comparison to their competitors. Also, we work a lot in the clinical trial space, both in terms of clinical trial structuring and feasibility for inclusion-exclusion criteria, because we can build virtual data cohorts of patients against the inclusion-exclusion criteria for the clinical trial and test those out in the real world to see, actually, if you apply this particular clinical trial inclusion or exclusion criteria, do you suddenly lose all your patients potentially from the study because it's too strict? And then the other area that we are particularly proud of is synthetic control arms, which are a relatively new approach that's only really become possible through the availability of this deep, highly curated data sets for and longitudinal data sets in patients. And synthetic control arms are really, they're now mandated by the FDA and the EMEA for certain situations. And those situations include rare and orphan diseases where the populations are so small, it's actually unethical or difficult to have phase three study designs where you have a non-treatment arm. And also ultra rare and rare diseases where you have very few patients. And it's also unethical to not give the patients a treatment modality in a clinical trial setting. And so what this does is it reduces patient burden, which is what we're particularly interested in. What it does for the pharmaceutical companies is it potentially speeds up and reduces costs in those trials as well. So it's kind of, again, it's a holy trinity of good effect. But it's only in certain circumstances, and you do need access to and the ability to interrogate deep longitudinal data sets across very large patient populations in order to generate the cohort sizes you need for those synthetic control arms. And again, I think with Sensign Health's access to electronic healthcare records directly, that gives us the ability and the advantage to do that, unlike other patient data sets that are available, notably in the US. So claims data, for instance, which is more freely available and from the US, where you can get very large data sets of patients, but where the data is not very longitudinal in nature. And it's really a point solution against a particular medical claim or intervention that that patient has had under a medical insurance provision.
We've written about synthetic control arms, and it's probably been around for a lot longer than what we see in practice right now, but we are hearing so much more about it. And obviously, if it's an FDA and EMEA, you know, mandate, and it makes sense, you know, with the ethics involved with the smaller populations and the rare diseases.
Yeah. And I think the reason you're hearing more about it, though, is that we've reached a kind of inflection point where both the technology, the ability to handle large data sets, and the access to the data have come together and enabled them to be possible.
Yeah.
Because I think before there just wasn't the technology to support managing the data. I mean, for instance, all of our work is done in the cloud. We don't have racks of big servers anymore. And that has enabled us to rapidly manage and integrate large data sets. And I think the other challenge that the industry faces or has faced here is data interoperability. So you've got, even in the NHS, you've got so many different EHR systems in operation. Getting the data sets to communicate between those is a real challenge. And we've developed the common data model that we use to enable that data interoperability to occur. And that's been a significant, you know, technology challenge we overcome and had to overcome in order to get where we are today.
If I could just jump in, Martin, could you kind of take us through and explain kind of the difficulty of integrating all that data together to make more sense?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about it, a patient's health record has so many different components to it. Some are called structured data, and they're quite simple. So if they've been prescribed a medication, so the medication name, the dose, the frequency, that's fine. But then you've got doctor's notes, which are unstructured data. You've got imaging data. So you've got x-rays, CAT scans, MRI scans, annotations of those. You've got pathology reports, which are in PDF formats. So you've got multiple formats. You've got multiple information sources all on one patient, probably in different locations. And you've got to make sense of all of that and bring it all together, relate it to the patient, obviously de-identify and anonymize it, and then aggregate it into data sets that make sense for disease areas, indications, that kind of thing. And then there's also outcomes. I mean, none of this data is useful unless you know the outcome for the patient. And that's probably the biggest sort of value driver of the data from my perspective for a pharma. So bringing all of that together in a common data model is hugely challenging, even within one institution, let alone when you're looking at different institutions in different geographies or with different systems. So it's a very non-trivial problem that we've overcome, and it explains why. I mean, we've been going for 3.5-4 years now. And I would say, obviously, you know, the vast sort of initial technology hurdle we had to overcome was building that common data model.
I think the back-end work that went into that is way beyond my understanding, but
mine too.
It doesn't sound trivial, that's for sure, because we do know, especially here in the US, how many different EHRs and claims. Well, there's actually only a few now, but back in the day, there was like over 600 EHR records, I mean, EHR systems, and I can't imagine having to put them all together to make sense. So the other question I have, so you aggregate the data, but pharma and CROs still kind of operate in functional silos. So your startup piece is different from your adherence piece, different from your, you know, the day-to-day handling in the trial. And then also with this data, you could see commercial benefits as well as research benefits. So who do you contract with? Are you contracting with a specific department, or is it an overall piece where they can use the data for any use?
Yeah, so that's really, it depends a bit on the groups we're working with. So the way that we stratify our customer groups is I've broken them out into the large. I call them the large, and that's the top 25 pharma.
Right.
And in the case of the top 25 pharma, we're engaging obviously with clinical, but also market access from the commercial side, and also even drug discovery as well. So our engagement is really probably at the program director level in clinical and above for pharma. And for market access, it's going to be people that are responsible for either a therapy area or a particular program of trials against an indication where they're hoping to launch. So it's very much, as you know, pharma can be quite siloed. So it's very much on a sort of individual basis. As you move down into the smaller customers, then it tends to be a bit more A, personal, and B, a bit more all-encompassing and a bit more fluid. But we're still dealing at the CMO, CSO level, heads of clinical research. If they have a separate market access function, then the head of that function probably. But the other side of this is the way that we make our data or our insights from our data available has changed in recent times. So we launched in September, we launched a analytical tool platform called Sensite, which is really aimed at being the Bloomberg terminal for life sciences, as we call it. And our competitors who offer, you know, data solutions, particularly in the patient recruitment clinical trial space, these are seven-figure enterprise-wide deals. But what we've done with the Sensite platform is make that much more democratizable data share. So each seat with Sensite is only £25,000, $35,000. And for that seat, you get access to the insights derived from our data sets. So you have the ability to use automated tools that we've developed within the platform to do such things as run feasibility studies on synthetic control arms, for instance. So you can scenario model as I said before, around cohort development. You can build a cohort of patients within the platform and scenario model whether or not your inclusion exclusion criteria work for that data cohort. And you can do that in real time pretty much. So, I mean, we launched the product in September with about six disease areas within it, and we're building those out as we grow and add them, because obviously it's a non-trivial exercise again. But as a way of accessing the data quickly and coming to some fairly quick answers, I think it's an unparalleled tool. What we do on the back of that is what we've always done, which is what I call professional services, where we're, you know, we're working as a partner with Big Pharma to build out synthetic control arms in great detail, to build enriched data cohorts of patients to address certain questions that the pharma wants to address around either an indication or a drug area. So it's really, it depends on which tool, which product we're developing. We have actually sold some seats for Sensight. So we've sold about 15 seats to date of the, even though we only launched in September. The other thing that we did announce that I think it's a really exciting potential collaboration is the Exscientia one, which we announced just before Christmas, where, I mean, they have bought some Sensight seats, but it's more around a collaboration with their sort of discovery AI, with our clinical AI, to see how we can help them accelerate the development of their novel IP. I think that's a very, that could be a really interesting collaboration to follow up on when we've got some results from that.
That sounds very forward thinking. That would be interesting to see.
We also, interestingly, produce a number of apps for patients, which are around tracking patient journey, patient outcome. The best known of those is one for gestational diabetes care management. And that app is in over half the UK trusts and has been used by over 45,000 patients, for instance, to date. And that's another way of us giving back to the patient, because that actually has had a big impact on both gestational diabetes care management for the mothers, but also led to the safe delivery of a very large number of newborns, which is, you know, from my perspective, a really good thing. So it does depend. So with the Sensight platform, you know, we're mostly targeting the SME space with a SaaS sales model. So software as a service. It's designed to be a user interface tool that the user can use on their own and get their own benefit from. But obviously with our support, they can do other things as well.
So do CROs use it at all?
So we're in discussions actually with four of the main five CROs on accessing the technology. We're actually in discussions with over half of the top 10 pharma as well. And we've worked with the likes of Bayer and Roche, BMS, successfully on projects for a number of years, actually. So yes, it's a short answer.
So I think you've touched on this next question, because you have worked in a variety of roles at other AI companies and CROs. And I was going to ask you what you saw as the most significant change in drug development in the past 10 years or the past 5 years. You did mention in the cloud, you know, software as a service, but if you could just expand on what you've seen.
Yeah, because I mean, back in the day, in my early career, I was actually in clinical research. I started my pharmaceutical career carrying the bag for a year and then went into clinical research, and I ran clinical trials in areas as diverse as female health and oncology. And obviously the advent and increase in Wi-Fi enabled technologies has made a big difference at the very sharp end of that process, with things like source data verification for CRAs, where, you know, in my day you had to try and decipher doctors' handwriting, which was impossible, and reconcile that to the patient's actual records, which was also pretty much impossible. Nowadays, obviously, with the advent of electronic health records, electronic CRFs, the job of the CRAs is much, much easier than it was in my day. I do think, as I said earlier, though, the key revolution here is this kind of data revolution tied in with the development of the technologies to enable access to that data in a secure environment. And being able to then apply that to not just the clinical research process, but also, you know, the market access for new drugs, pricing models, HUR models for drugs, is making a big difference. I think there's still a long way to go. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has always been quite slow in adopting new technologies, particularly large pharma, because of the scale of them, because it costs so much money just to move on to the next MS Word package, for instance, let alone change how you do stuff. But I do think that that these new technologies are going to make a difference, and using ML, NL approaches has accelerated the ability to do that at scale with very large data sets. And that's really, that's the era we're moving in now. That's where we are now, where that is making a big difference.
So Martin, just to wrap up, what should ClinOps executives and industry professionals be looking out for over the horizon as we kind of move forward here?
Yeah, it's obviously a bit more of the same in terms of access to large data sets and applying that and learning how that can help accelerate clinical development. I think it's been hard to accelerate clinical development meaningfully, particularly in the background of increased stringency from the regulatory bodies. But I do think the application of these technologies could help that. What I'm quite excited by is the ability for AI approaches to predict patient outcome, predict the effect of a new drug in patients at an earlier stage of development. So for me, the holy grail would be you've discovered a new target in oncology, for instance. You've been able to model the chemistry of the molecule that will interrupt that target. So companies like Exscientia, who in fact we partner with, can already do this to a degree, and that already saves 18 months time in that early discovery part of the process. But then what would be great would be to look at the predictive qualities of that molecule and be able to predict the phase two outcome for that molecule or the phase three outcome for that molecule successfully. And then you cut down massively on the entire clinical trials process and you speed everything up immensely. You lose costs. You still need to validate the drug in clinical trials. But if you can actually predict the behavior of that drug in a complex biological system like a human being with great accuracy, then you've got a winner. And that for me is where this is all heading.
That's excellent. I mean, it's happening so fast. There's going to be a lot of change management issues. I mean, you know, when you get into the day-to-day, but I can see that.
It's a paradigm shift. And I think Obviously it will need to be approved and led by the regulators. So just as BYOD, bring your own device in ePro, eCOA systems only really came in when the FDA mandated they could be used. And then people spent the time, effort and money to develop them. It's the same with synthetic control arms, because they're now allowed, for want of a better word, in certain indications. We're now seeing that in concert with the ability of companies like ours to successfully aggregate those large, deep data sets and analyze them. You're seeing them grow in importance and commonality. I think the barrier to entry for these more predictive approaches is necessarily high. So it's not necessarily just around the corner, but I know there are people working in these sorts of fields and areas. And anything you can do to speed up the clinical drug development process and reduce costs is an absolute winner for industry, because obviously it's being crippled over the last two decades or so or more by just the rising cost of developing a new drug. And that cost is built up of all the failures that go along the way to that drug becoming successful because of attritional risk in the drug development process.
It all makes perfect sense, Martin. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And we look forward to hearing more about, you know, your achievements as you move forward and maybe some case studies and such. That would be excellent.
So yeah, I'd be very happy to rejoin you and give you an update. Thank you.
What if you had limitless access to customer insights, accelerated timelines, and set fees? At True Serum Network, we're fueled by connections in virtually every area of healthcare as part of MJH Life Sciences. The result? Audience-fed creative and more powerful content in less time. True Serum Network, releasing what's real. Find out more at TrueSerumNTWK.com.